The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
And this is being recorded for the podcast. I think it'll pick up all of us. So I think we'll get started. I don't know why I'm...
Please.
You're in the center. Maybe you
no,
should
no,
just...
No, 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 no. You're a little
so,
left.
So our proposal, unless somebody has... has a different proposal, is we'll introduce ourselves and give a little bit about what our role is in international law and maybe say a few things about some of the courses generally. We don't have an orchestrated, at least I didn't get the memo
on
a package deal. Professor Bradlow is on the way. In fact, I see him right there. Maybe he's going to chair.
No, you're already in charge.
He's last, so he gets to chair. So I was just saying, Professor Bradlow, that we'll do a quick, short introduction and statement about what we both teach and what we can answer questions about, and a little bit whatever we want to say about the international curriculum, and then we'll take it questions. I think questions are probably better than listening to us. So I'll start. I'm David Hunter. My area that I teach in is international environmental law. I also direct the International Legal Studies Program, which gives me a little bit of a perspective on the curriculum generally, although that program operates the LLM program. I have some information about, areas that other people may not know very much about, although I may not know the answer either. And let me just say very quickly about the international law offerings, international environmental law offerings. And that is that in the fall we'll have a couple of courses around international environmental law. They're not actually ironed down yet about the time, so they'll make it a little difficult for you to add right now. One is on comparative environmental law that I will be teaching. We also expect to have a climate change law course that the same adjunct that taught it last year will be teaching, which is both domestic and international. There's a course on law of the sea that is settled here that's taught by Professor Orellana, which deals with all law of the sea type questions, but he particularly has an environmental and sustainable development focus. There are also some courses involving oil and gas and energy, which I'll just mention that those are also offered in the fall. I want to say as well that a lot of the international environmental curriculum is found in the summer session, the three-week summer session on environmental law, where there are seven or eight courses offered from the starting the day after Memorial Day. You can take you don't have to go for the full 3 weeks for the environmental classes. You can take one or another one or a different one. And there's also an environmental law course offered as part of the European summer program. So I can answer more questions about those in details. But that's kind of the structure. The structure for international environmental law kind of assumes that you may take some of the summer courses since there's a lot of the curriculum there. But there will be a couple offered in the fall as well. I'll stop there. And
can I ask just a general question?
Yeah.
All of you are first years, right? And how many of you are taking the elective on international law now? So let me ask it the other way around. How many of you are not?
About half.
Okay. That's good.
That is good data.
Okay.
Because if you've taken the elective on international law, then you're more... We don't have that many formal prerequisites in the international law program, but obviously having the general international law course is not a bad thing to have early if you're very interested in international law and want to take some of the other specializations. So that may have been partly the motivation.
Yep.
Is that fair?
Exactly.
Please.
Well, I'm Carlos Portales, the director of the International Organization's Law and Diplomacy Program. This is a new summer program that will start this year. It combines the legal approach with the international studies approach and political science approach. We will have 3 weeks here in Washington from June the 6th to June the 24th, and 2 weeks in Geneva. We will have eight courses here, Law of International Organization, International Development Organization, one about the Criminal Court, one about Regional Organization, one about the European Union law, and two courses on crisis situation and the course on international institution and environmental protection that belongs to the other program too. And in Geneva, we will have four courses, one related with the World Trade Organization, one with the World Intellectual Property Organization, one with human rights and international humanitarian law, and the last one with the International Labor Organization. The idea is to have short courses with the main theoretical topics, but also with the practical dimension of interchange with officials in the international organization involved. You may choose to do both courses in Washington and Geneva, or only in Washington. That's the rule for JD students. And, well, I can answer question at the end.
And he brought brochures.
And have brochures and a list of for those of you who want more information on the program.
Terrific. Is this a question time, or do we wait till the end?
Let's do the little brief one.
Little brief from everyone, and then we'll take more questions.
Needs lots of time. And apropos of the mention of summer programs, I have been involved in, my name's Rick Wilson. I'm the director of the Human Rights Clinic, and have been involved in several of the summer programs that I think have a tremendous appeal to first years, rising second years, who don't find legal employment, or at least legal employment that in your area of passion. And I have been involved for three summers with the Hague program that includes the course in international criminal law and law and terrorism. The Chile program that has a course in human rights and a course in international commercial law, trade law. And this coming summer, I'll be involved in one of the components of the Paris Week on Human Rights in the Paris, Geneva, Brussels, and various cities of Europe program that I'm also very excited. This is the first time I'm going to be doing that program. My main work is in the Human Rights Clinic here at the law school, where I've been director of the clinic for its 21 years now of operation. A lot of time that we've been doing this. I think I'll answer questions about clinic in general, but I think it's safe to say if you were around for the general clinic meeting, or some of you may have applied to clinic as rising 2Ls for next year, you're aware of how difficult it is to get into the clinics in your second year. And I think this year was a banner year for third years as well as second year. So it is an incredibly popular program, and we'll go through that same cycle next year. That is a different cycle for registration or for enrollment than the normal sort of lottery system pre-registration. So I can talk a little bit more about that, but I think if you've been through it this once, you're probably veterans enough to know how to manage it next year as well, when you're a rising 3L and your chances of getting into clinic, I think, are a good deal better. And I do want to just make a general plug in favor of thinking about clinics in general. It is not the International Human Rights Law Clinic is the only clinic that devotes itself to the use of international law in a clinical context, although a few of the clinics, disabilities, intellectual property.
Immigration. You guys do immigration, not a human rights.
Immigration, I would say that we used to do immigration. Now that we have this immigrant justice clinic that is on its own and mostly is focused on law in the United States and immigrant situations in the United States. So with those couple of other programs that have occasional projects that reach out into international law, I would say international law in the clinic program is focused in the International Human Rights Law Clinic. I also teach outside of the clinic. I've taught the course that Professor Mendez is teaching now, the international law first year elective course, a couple of times. And then I teach seminars that focus on economic, social, and cultural rights, a course on global public interest practice that kind of looks at how public interest law has evolved from the United States and more globally into the NGO movement in contemporary law and a little bit of history, and very occasionally teach a course in comparative criminal procedure and human rights. So.
I'm Juan Mendez, and as Rick just said, and many of you know because you're taking my course, I teach one of the electives in international law. It's my second year doing it, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Everything else I teach is in the human rights field. This semester I'm teaching a comparative regional protection course. It's called Regional Approaches to Human Rights, and it basically compares the systems that are in use in Europe, Africa, and the Americas. In the fall semester, I teach a seminar on prevention of genocide that now is going to be expanded to be prevention of genocide, torture, and other international crimes. And the other course that I teach, I picked up from Professor Goldman, who used to teach it here. It's called Advanced Human Rights, and it's a little more combination of comparative and international law, and it's an in-depth look at certain rights, not all of them, and how they can be, how they have been treated in domestic and international law, you know, and with a certain practitioner's approach to it, so that you know how to, you know, litigate, how to get into court and stay there and obtain a favorable result. I'm also teaching in the summer academy here. This year I'm teaching in Spanish, and it's a course on countering impunity for serious human rights crimes. And I'm also going to the Chile program this summer. And just extracurricularly, but things that may have some bearing on interest for students, I'm the special rapporteur for the United Nations on torture. For the next 3 years, and I'm also a special advisor to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and I'm the co-chair of the Human Rights Institute of the International Bar Association. All of these are volunteer things, so they take me a lot of time, but I mention them because I mention them because they might have some bearing for people who might want to do some independent study, some additional research, etc.
It's about time you start taking on some responsibilities.
Yeah. I think you do enough around here.
Danny?
I'm Danny Bradlow. I teach on the faculty here sometimes. I teach international this semester I'm teaching international financial law and development finance, which probably has the dubious distinction of having the longest title of any course in the law school. But it's basically a course on international financial law. And then I teach a course on international organizations. And I'll be teaching a course on international organizations in the summer in this international organizations course. The reason I said I sometimes teach is I also have an appointment at the University of Pretoria in South Africa, where I run an international development law unit that does research projects on global governance and on foreign investment and human rights issues. And if anybody's interested in spending a summer as an intern in South Africa, you should speak to me, because we have internship possibilities, both in my unit and in the Center for Human Rights, and I can be happy to tell you about that. And I'll be in South Africa next year, so I won't be teaching next year. But I'll be back in fall of 2012, and I'll probably be teaching the same courses I'm teaching now. What else should I say? I mean, I suppose also just by way of extra activities, I'm the chair of the African Development Bank's Independent Review Mechanism. Those of you know the World Bank Inspection Panel, that we are the African Development Bank's equivalent of that. So we investigate complaints from people who say they've been harmed by projects funded by the African Development Bank, where the African Development Bank hasn't complied with its own policies and procedures. I don't know what I should add. I think that, for starters, that's
good.
I also, well, just the only other thing I'd add is over the years that I've been at the law school for over 20 years, and I've taught courses in international trade and international business law as well. So if you have questions on those, I'm happy to answer that as well.
So we cover most of the areas collectively.
Yeah.
Questions? Rick, why don't you handle the questions?
I applied for this program yesterday. I'm curious about that. I haven't seen what the schedule looks like, or also if the application process is still a selection, if I should be registering for other classes while I wait to find out about that.
You will have all the call us and you will have all the information in details.
I'm sorry?
You can call us and have all the information in details.
Yes, what sort of prerequisites do you require for the international financing courses? Are there prerequisites that they need other than general international?
There's no formal prerequisites, and so, but what I would say, and it's, the course is designed as an introductory course, so that I don't expect anyone to have a particular background in it. But I would say that probably it would be good to have done international law, and it would be good to have done some basic corporate courses, and other than that, I can give you the rest of what you need in the course.
And there's also just, in the fall, there's international finance taught by Professor Galpern, which is public international organizations, International Monetary Fund, and there's also an international project finance class, which is more organized around private business transactions. So you can kind of line yourself up with what you're interested in.
Oh, actually, if you do both of those, don't do my course, because we cover the same things. if you've done Anna's course and the project finance, I think you've probably learned what you would learn in my course.
There was another hand back there. Did you?
Just two questions. First, I'm taking Professor Nicola's comparative law class right now. I was just wondering what would be a good course to follow after that. I do like the comparative law issue. Just wondering what might follow or what you would recommend following after the course of that.
I think that I don't know that I have a particular path that is a sort of the path that I would recommend. I probably have done this session with Professor Bradlow over the years, and I think you've heard from us both the suggestion that you take a broad base of international law courses, comparative law courses, and that you get that those building blocks from the basic courses, the introductory course that you're taking, the survey course that you're taking in international law now is just as valuable as a comparative law course, but they're very different in terms of their content because one is comparative law and the other is international law, which are very different topics, very different coverage of material. And I candidly think we have more offerings in the international law area than we have in the comparative law area. So it's really terrific that you're having this opportunity to get exposed to the different legal systems, which I think a lot of the way we think about the sort of traditions of the civil law and the common law and other legal systems infuse international law in ways that I think are very helpful to understand as you're going forward. It's just that I don't think many law schools in the United States have a lot of comparative law offerings because international law is more popular, if you will. It is just a fact of the way law schools offer the courses. And I think there are a new group of comparative law scholars, like Professor Nicola, who are infusing comparative law with a sort of new energy that is giving it direction that isn't the sort of old, worn-out methods of comparing just the European civil law to the U.S. common law. It's a much, much richer topic. Go ahead.
When you're done.
Oh. No, please.
I was just lying myself.
Because I'll blather on forever.
Oh, well, I was going to say that though I agree with all that blathering on. though I agree with all that, and I think in this coming fall, which may not be the case in other semesters, if you're very interested in comparative law, there's a set of classes that are offered that may not be available. I can't guarantee they'll be available your third year. So depending on your specific interests in comparative law, there's a class on comparative media law. There are comparative constitutional law, which will probably be taught every year. Mm-hmm. Comparative environmental law, which probably won't be taught every year, but maybe the next two, I teach that one. There's a comparative family law class for the fall that hasn't historically been offered. So it happens that this coming fall we have, I think, four or five classes that are strictly comparative or primarily comparative as opposed to international, which gives you a different chance to build on that may not be available in other semesters because of the things that Rick said. So I also agree with the broader, you know, trying to get different focuses and things on that, but I think you have a chance to take a seminar or two on a more specific topic you might be interested in.
I think one really concrete hint is the difference between what you see in the catalog and what you see on your course listings in the pre-registration is fairly significant. So when you're looking at the catalog and you see a teacher's name associated with a course, check with that teacher because, as David said, not all teachers teach all courses in all terms. And so if you see one that you just say, oh, I got to have this course before I get out of law school, check with the teacher to see if it's going to be offered in the coming year or in the 2 years you have remaining here, because most of us have at least some idea of what our sort of trajectory of courses is going to look like in the next couple of years. And that's particularly true, I think, for adjuncts.
Can I just add something?
Sure.
Which I know Rick doesn't agree with. I don't know if anybody else on the panel is. But I think it's very important as you're planning your courses to remember that you're being trained as American lawyers and not to do only international courses. And to do, for example, comparative family law is a great course to do, and I'm not suggesting don't do it. But don't think you're going to learn family law, that's the best way to learn family law. I mean, you're getting a comparative law, but if you want to know family law, you should do a course on American family law.
Absolutely.
And you need to make sure also that, because your credibility as a lawyer, if you work as an international lawyer, is going to depend on being able to prove that you're a good lawyer. And to do that, you need to have the skills that a good American lawyer has. And so you need to make sure that you do the range of basic law courses that every lawyer should know. I don't think you should specialize more than necessary. That you should do not only the required law courses, but you should do things like business associations. You should do tax. You should do administrative law, federal courts, because we live in a federal society, and you need to understand how that works. So you should do that just because you need evidence, even if you never want to be a litigator. And I never wanted to be a litigator, but I can tell you learning evidence was really important. You learn things about how to think like a lawyer that you just don't learn in other settings. So I would say you should do all of that, not only because you need it, but also you never know what course you're going to do that's really going to turn you on. I mean, the number of people who go into tax thinking I should do tax and come out saying I really want to be a tax lawyer, which might seem inconceivable to you now, but don't know that. And even if it's important to remember that public interest work needs good tax lawyers and good business lawyers as well. And if the only people who ever do tax and business courses are people who want to make a lot of money and don't care about public interest, a lot of public interest needs are not going to be met. And so you should do whatever your interests are. You really need to do some of these courses. And those of you who are interested in business, I would say you should make sure you do environment courses and human rights courses, because you'll be a much better business lawyer if you understand those issues as well.
Yes.
Is there any particular classes that you recommend us taking in the summer in terms of course offerings? Or
I think we have the courses abroad. Some of the ones I mentioned, the one you just heard about, the new one, I think are amazing opportunities. I think the Summers Human Rights Institute that is also a terrific example of an immersion experience. I think a lot of students eyes are bigger than their stomachs for those courses because those courses are very compressed. They're in a very short time period, so you're at it every single day. And so I wouldn't recommend taking three courses during the summer in the Institute, for example. I think those who have done that regret it. I think there are the offerings in the summer in the evening program, just the general evening program, I actually wouldn't differ that much from Danny's advice about the building blocks and thinking about most of yourselves as future American lawyers, if that's the direction that you're headed. I think if I disagree, it's more in the sort of contextualization of your experience here, where it feels to me as though you have 3 years, you're paying a lot of money for those 3 years. It feels to me as though following your bliss is not a bad thing. That doing the things you love is a one-time opportunity to do those courses that you have thought about and dreamed about doing. And so I favor taking the courses that you love. The difficulty with that at this school is that there is so much to love. There is a particularly in the international law area, it's always, I can't tell you how many times I counsel students on, it's this course at this time versus another course at the same time that is on just as good a topic that it would be just as much fun to take. And it's wonderful in a way to have that dilemma, because there are many, many schools where that is not a dilemma, and where finding one or two international law offerings is you're lucky to be able to find those. Here, I don't know, you did a tally of this or once, and it was an enormous number of courses that are listed in the
International law courses?
International law courses.
I have the advantage of actually having the list of international law courses in front of me for the fall, and it's double-sided.
Yeah.
That's just the international. It doesn't include, for example, the courses that are U.S. law that deal with extraterritorial, like immigration or
right.
national security or things like that. So, yeah, we have a
tremendous
number of
offers. It is really an embarrassment of riches. So I think that is the real challenge. I want to offer an observation. I came off of a leave last year where I had a chance to talk to. I spent one semester in the Netherlands visiting at the University of Utrecht in their human rights program, and a lot of the students there were American students studying abroad, getting masters and PhDs in Europe. Then I came back and spent a semester as a fellow at the American Society of International Law down the block in Sheridan Circle, and met and talked to a lot of international lawyers there. And it sort of reinforced my sense that this school's strength is in public international law. And that when you think about the sort of, law is filled with hierarchies. There's hierarchies in public interest law. There are hierarchies between big firms and small firms, and between international practice and domestic practice. And my sense is, that when you come into law school and you say, I want to do international law, I'm really interested in practicing international law, that you're not aware of until the sort of reality hits you in the interviewing season, you're not aware of how those issues play out in the field. So there is big law, there are the big firms that do international law and have offices everywhere in the world, and so the dream of being an associate in the Paris office of a big firm is mostly private law. It's mostly private commercial law, and some of the students who graduate from my clinic go into that area of law, but most folks, I think of international law in a little bit different way than that, and maybe you do, maybe you don't. I'm not endorsing one or the other. That it is certainly where the money is if you're looking for making money when you graduate. Those are the folks who
make the salaries in excess of $120,000-$150,000 in their first year out of law school. So that's, but those are also very plum jobs that go to the schools that are above us in the rankings in international law. Those are the private international law schools. This is the highest ranked public international law school. We focus on human rights. We focus on international organizations. We focus in international environmental law. Those are all public international law topics, and they are and the jobs are different than big law jobs, I think. That's not to say worse or better. They're different, and the trajectory of seeking them is different. I think in international organizations, U.S. lawyers suffer if only because of the fact that you are U.S. lawyers and that those international organizations are looking for people with diversity in terms of geographic diversity, and there are so many U.S. lawyers in general that it's hard for U.S. lawyers to find a slot. With all due deference, I know the program is going to be fantastic and you should all think about it. It is possible. I have graduates from the clinic, again, who are working in international organizations and loving it. But usually they trade on language, ethnic background, and ability to sort of repackage themselves as something more or different than the classic sort of American lawyer graduate. So that if you can do that, that's terrific. And then the public interest area, the public interest realm, is another area entirely. So human rights NGOs, for example, and maybe international environmental NGOs, have a different sort of feel to them and a different trajectory in terms of how they hire. It's a slower process. When we were talking to admitted students last Friday, Jared Shirk was talking about the rhythm of hiring for both summer internships and firm jobs that is so different in the public interest field, so that the fall is interviewing season for the big firms and the late spring is interviewing season for the public interest firms. When they can get around to it and they realize, oh my God, we have to hire somebody and let's do that instead of doing everything else that we have to do in this tiny little organization that is struggling to stay alive because we get foundation grants and need to keep ourselves going. If you all have paid any attention to that, you're beginning to see that those hierarchies play out in your own process of choosing courses. So with that in mind, I think that gives, certainly to me, that gives a little more context to the choices you make about the trajectory of courses that you choose and what your options are as you begin to get your first year grades and you're deciding what you're going to do with the things like law review and those kinds of things.
Well, let me just, I want to put a level of specificity to that in course selection. So public international law, that is the human rights field, international trade and WTO and things like that. I would disagree. I think there's a tremendous number of offerings on the private international law side. You just might not recognize them right at first. So things like international business transactions, international contract law, international petroleum transactions, international project finance, and I think there's a couple others. I'm just naming the ones that are offered this fall that are private international law courses that are more about international business and the concept of transnational business. So I think Rick is absolutely right that it's sometimes late in your career as a student that you start to understand, I wouldn't call it the hierarchies, but the differences in the...
I'm going for hierarchies.
I'm not. Only if you put international environmental law on the top, the hierarchy. But it is valuable to recognize if you're interested in the business side of things, then I just was counseling an LLM student who came in and said, you know, I didn't realize international trade is so public international law when I really want to do international business transactions. So the sooner you kind of understand those differences, because that's really the corporate practice and is the private international law. So the courses are definitely there. And in both cases, I agree that, you know, the building blocks of the basic law classes are very important for you to have because they give you the groundwork for going any direction in your career. And I agree with the ones that Danny listed.
Yes?
I'm interested in practicing public international law, so thank you for that. I think Professor Wilson gave a really good how important or how valuable do you think doing a master's in at the SIS is? That's something I'm considering, but weighing whether, you know, the additional $30,000 or $15,000, however much that extra semester will cost, like how valuable do you think that is, or can I achieve the goals that I may be able to achieve through SIS by just doing a JD and getting and taking classes that are either offered at SIS or just more public international classes?
Well, I think there's, I think the best person to talk to about that is Paul Williams, who is the director of the joint degree program. He has an office here, and he also has an office up at SIS. The description you heard of this new summer program that combines international relations and law together, I think, is a trend. And this, and I think we're trying to stay on the cutting edge with this kind of course offering. That combination is a terrific combination. Are any of you in the joint degree program, the SIS program? Lots of folks here. So I think talk to your colleagues, too, who are in the program and see how it's going for them. Talk to the people who are raising their hands now who are in the program who might think about doing it. Again, I probably have about five or six students in my clinic in their third year every year who are in the program. For the most part, I think they're happy, quite happy that they're doing them. My sense is that law school eats up so much of your life and your mind that they put off the degree at SIS, or they take little snippets of courses while they're in law school, and then do a big chunk of it after they literally after the 3 years of law school. So one semester or even two semesters in residence up at SIS. It's not so much taking both courses together, which would be the ideal way to do it, but almost end-to-end because law school is so time-consuming. That's just an impression that I have from those students. Whether or not it makes you more employable, I don't know what the statistics are on that. And I think for me it's much more about what do you get from it in terms of how it broadens your perspective on things. But definitely talking to Paul Williams is the recommendation. Yes?
So what course specifically or courses would you recommend in this fall semester coming up that might be able to get something out of the way? So I don't want to be like a 3L that says, oh, I wish I had taken this during my second year so I could do this other fantastic thing. Like when you look at your students' trends, what would you recommend to get out of the way your first semester of your second year?
I think there are different views about that.
Yeah, I would say take the required, so what criminal procedure and ethics, and get that out of the way. I think you should do early on business associations and tax and administrative law, because I think that gives you the basis for doing a lot of other courses that build on that.
And
then
you have federal tax or what type
personal
of
income tax?
Personal income tax. I actually don't disagree with that. I think those are incredibly valuable courses. They're all bar courses, and I'm not a big fan of designing your curriculum around passing the bar. I think any of you who are smart enough to get in here are smart enough to pass the bar. Believe me, you are. So that you could take no bar courses and cram during that 3 months before the bar and pass the bar. Really good.
Excellent.
But I'm not suggesting that you do that. I think there are some real advantages to taking. I mean, there's a reason why those are bar courses.
And for those of you who haven't done public international law, I say do public international law.
For
a semester so that you've got the basis for any other international course you want to do.
And I agree with that, except I would put one other caveat, which is you just got done with a year where you were told what you had to take, and you only got an option of one class. So don't feel like, oh my God, my fall has just been taken up by the courses I must take. Among those courses, you should take some of those in the first semester and think about getting them off early. And you can spread some of them too. In fact, I don't think those courses are the ones you'll say at the end, I wish I'd taken it earlier, but I think they're ones you should take early because they help you get into, the discussion of comparative law, for example. If you really want to get the most out of one of those more detailed comparative law courses, then it would be great if you've already had some exposure to more of U.S. law before you take it. I think you get more out of the comparison then. So.
Can I just clarify that administrative law, is that what it's called, or is it?
Yeah,
exactly.
It's the law of public government agencies.
Agencies,
basically, but we call it administrative law. Some of you may be taking a. Are we offering a law in public regulation? Yeah, mm-hmm. public law, mm-hmm. Which is essentially administrative law as a first-year elective.
The backbone of, I mean, for those of you who think about potential work in the government, I think that there's so much more work done by lawyers at the agency level and at the administrative law level than there is done in the glorified U.S. courts or the glitzy litigation that goes on. There is an immense amount of work, and the regime is really important to understand.
Because the other thing is, you'll understand when you eventually get to do international organizations, you'll understand them so much better if you've done it administratively. Mm-hmm.
There's a growing field. I thought you were going to say there's a growing field that Danny and I are very active and interested in international administrative law, or how international organizations, what procedures and processes mm-hmm. they do, and they're really borrowing a lot of concepts from. Domestic administrative law, so it's actually even more relevant today than it would have been 10 years ago, I think, for international law.
Yes?
Is there anything that you suggest to consider when thinking about taking seminar classes, like with next semester, be too early to take one of those courses, or do you think you should wait to get a better feel for what we're really interested in, particularly if we're thinking of using that as the upper level of
training? I go back to what I just said, which is that there's some building block classes, but there's also, you've been spoon-fed what you have to take.
Right.
So if there's a class you think looks very interesting, and I don't think there's any particular reason to wait that you can't handle a seminar or something like that. I think, and you've also been in big classes for the most part, and the seminar gives you a chance to be in a small, more discussion thing. So for those reasons, I would say, try to mix it up a little bit. So if you're taking two or three that are bigger basic courses, then taking a small class where it's probably not going to be an exam but a paper is probably a nice mix. I don't think there's a general rule for it. And it's a good way of as you go through, you may also want to think about taking a seminar on something you have, especially as you get into your third year. It just looks interesting and it's completely different. You may find your love, or you take advantage of being able to spend time talking about an issue that's interesting to you. So, and as far as getting over that upper level writing requirement, I don't think you have to worry about doing that too early. You'll have chances as you move along to do it. And there aren't that many students I run into who come to their third last semester and say, "Oh my gosh, I forgot to do the upper level writing requirement." You can get that requirement from journals and from other things. So you have to pay attention to it, but you don't have to be in a hurry to do it your first semester of your second year.
And I guess the corollary of that is that seminars often offer that option to write longer and satisfy the upper level. I certainly do in my seminar. I like paper courses. I hear from students that a lot of students prefer an exam to a paper. I can't imagine why. I love papers, but that maybe that's just me.
Exams are less work. That's
exactly right. It takes a lot of work to do a paper, but I think it's such a great investment to and so many papers out of my seminars have turned into articles and then been published, sent out to law reviews. They're sort of the beginnings of thinking about an issue very deeply and engaging with something that you love with a group of people who have that similar sort of inclination in a much smaller 15 to 20 environment. I think it's a fundamentally different kind of teaching and a fundamentally different kind of engagement by students than a big tiered classroom with are you being called on today or not. So that it's just a different experience. Got to do it in law school.
I run my big classes like a cozy seminar.
Yeah, I'm sure.
One thing I would add to that, though, just as a thought, is that there's kind of a myth, in a way it's a myth, that all seminars are paper classes. I don't know if you've heard that. It's not accurate, actually. Professors are given the latitude to require either a paper or an exam. So even though it says seminar and you decide you really want to take a paper, it's still up. You still have to find out what that that professor is doing. I know a lot of mostly a lot of seminars are papers, but a lot of them are exams too.
Right. Yes.
Professor Hunter, you mentioned that there's a 3-week summer session on environmental law.
Mm-hmm.
If we're employed, I'm assuming we cannot do that.
You are wrong. no, so for this summer, wrong. So for the summer, for the environmental summer session, and actually I think for the other summer sessions, intellectual property and government and health that are here in Washington, they last for 3 weeks, but the courses are scattered. So if we take the environmental one as an example, there are 8 courses. Seven of them are 1 week long. You don't take all 7, and of those, 3 or 4 are in the evening. And you can just decide you're going to take one class and just take that one course. So you don't have to, you're not signing up for the whole session. In fact, you can't take all the courses. So there are options in the summer to be working and also take a night course or an evening course or two. And I think that's true for most of the summer courses mm-hmm. that are here in Washington. Mm-hmm. So we talk about them as a unified program, but for students that are here and registered, you don't have to take everything. In fact, you really can't. You can pick and choose, and some of them are designed for people who are working. And they also end early. So, for example, some of the courses are during the day, but they end on June 5th or something like that for the first week. So you could be starting your job afterwards or something like that. And they're designed that way as well. Most of them end in Washington. Yeah, yeah. So it opens along with the fall semester.
Other questions?
Jeremy, Professor Bradlow, you said that your class is similar to the international finance and international project finance classes. If we just were looking for a survey class of those subjects, would it be better to take yours then and combine those?
Probably. Professor Gilpin's class, I don't know well enough to know for sure, but I think she covers more. Because what I do is I look at what are all the sources of funds that borrowers in developing countries could tap into, and how do those sources work, and what do the agreements look like. I think she does something somewhat similar. Is it different?
Well, I don't think she takes that perspective, but it probably covers some of the same things.
So we look at World Bank, IMF.
She does too.
Export credits, private sector sources. So it is a survey course.
When are you thinking that's going to be offered?
Fall 2012.
Okay. Back here.
Yeah.
Because you're rotating every year. Yeah. So year here, year away.
Yes. No, just this year.
This year.
Okay.
When's a good idea to take evidence, and what other, how many heavy courses should we look at with mm-hmm. evidence in a semester?
Well, one relevant factor for that is that almost every clinical offering requires evidence. Some of that is because of court rules that say the students have to have it in order to be able to be certified under student practice rules. And another reason is you use it a lot. So in our case, you can take it at the same time you're taking clinic. I think some of the others have it as a prerequisite because you have to be finished with it when you enroll. So for us, it's just important to have the concept. So we have students who are taking it now as they finish clinic in their last semester. So I think it's one of those courses that I would put in the list of take them when you can. If you want to get them out of the way, it's one of those building brick courses. Very important to think about it, understand it, and of course there are an array of teachers who teach evidence with different reputations about how hard or how easy they are about
But it's a great writing. Course. Don't be afraid of it.
No, it's a great
course. We have great teachers. All of them are great teachers.
All of them are great teachers.
No, it's true, actually. We happen to have a complete wealth of
actually,
great evidence teachers.
The thing I learned about evidence is it's totally logical. And all you have to do is crack the logical code, and once you've done
yep.
that,
I never crack that code.
You're safe.
I'm dizzy after that.
hearsay is easy.
It's always easy after that.
But you can make educated guesses.
You're going to say the same thing about tax. You're going to say the same thing about tax, aren't you?
It is true. It is true. Okay. I don't know whether any of you have to go to class at 5. I don't know. I think we can want to try to finish by about 5, but Jeremy, let's do one more
just
question.
Just kind of coming off this clinic evidence, I applied for clinic this year, obviously, and I noticed that there were like 63 else who were turned away this year from clinics.
Yeah.
Is there anything we can do to help ourselves get into a clinic as
Talk
a
to the dean. we have. I'm
not going to associate myself with that conversation.
No, I think it makes a difference. I think you know, there are logical limits to what the program can offer. And we have a huge clinical program now. It's one of the richest and literally and figuratively in the nation. So we have a lot of offerings, but we also have a lot of interest. So I think the only way we can sort of scale the mountain is there. I mean, there are a couple of ways to deal with it. One is to expand the clinical offerings, and the other is to make more clinic-like substitutes that will satisfy your desire to get that kind of exposure to practice and in another curricular context. So there may be other ways we can go at that. I mean, externships come to mind, and more guided externships with greater student responsibility, I think, are possibilities in one way. A lot of schools consider externships to be a clinical experience. So this school has its own sort of definition of what constitutes a clinical experience, which I think has made us the strong program that we are. So I do think it's a matter of resources, and we are almost all of our clinics, virtually all except tax and I think intellectual property, are hard money out of the school's budget clinics. That is, we don't rely on outside funding from the federal government or anyplace else. So it's how we make our curricular choices.
And it's basically lottery to get into clinics.
Yeah,
right?
just about.
So we can't take more classes.
No, no.
Area.
I can't tell you. You know, you're gonna get a slotting clinic by taking.
And
that.
Just to add specificity to some of those other non-clinic options that give they don't give exactly the same thing, but just so you know, there's the Public Interest Law Project, which is not formally listed as a clinic, but mm-hmm. gives you hands-on experience. In the environmental area, we don't have an environmental clinic, but we have a very hands-on environmental externship concept using our place in Washington to give that kind of experiential learning with Professor Snape. The impact litigation project that the dean runs. These are other...
UNRO. UNRO clinic.
Yeah, that doesn't count as a clinic.
It's called the UNRO clinic. We gave it the name clinic because... that way they could buy malpractice insurance under our program.
So there are
to get sued, you don't lose all of the money you spend on law school.
Are also some of them are also lotteried or whatever, but they're there, so you can look for those other opportunities.
Right. All right, folks.
Good luck. Enjoy.
Thanks.
Professor,
hi.
My name is Christy. I'm Professor Schwen's international law student this semester. I emailed you earlier.
Would you mind just signing us?
Earthquake International this semester. Well, I accepted the position.
That looks really cool.
And I guess I'm just wondering from you.
No.